Hello and welcome to this episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast. It is episode 227 today, where we talk about some of your frequently asked questions in relation to SaaS. My name is Kane Glancy, and I am joined today with our host, Benga. Benga, how are we doing?
Yeah, fine. Thank you very much. I'm good. Great.
How did you find the session? It was an interesting one and another busy one.
Absolutely, yes. It was indeed thought-provoking getting to hear different conversations, opinions about the big problem, which is SaaS, and almost everyone in every organization is facing the same. So yeah, it was interesting.
Yeah, it's always great to get insights from different people. From what we found always from doing these sessions is that everybody has such differing views and opinions and ways that work. And what's great about data protection is that they all work. There are ways to do things differently that still work and you can still comply. And when things are a little bit difficult, when things are as great as they are in data protection, it's so great to have the network of the people that we do with their opinions so people can bounce around their ideas and feel comfortable in compliance with that. So it's always great. Our SaaS sessions are always super busy, which is great. We were specifically looking at a lot of the questions that we've received recently, so things that people really want to talk about. So it's always great when the chat is engaging loads. We had a few people unmute and let us know some of their approaches to SaaS. So that was always great to see. Are there any particular highlights to the session for you, Benga?
At the end of the day, I think one highlight that struck me is the dual hack is your absolute friend. It's not making life harder, it's giving the legal tools to be reasonable when you are conducting a SAR, which means you have to use scope clarification on every vague request, apply reasonable search principles, stop being terrified to set limits, then importantly, document everything if ever challenged.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So we want you all as soon as possible to get stuck in and listen straight to the session because we think it's a corker. But before I go, if you are listening to this on Spotify, we absolutely encourage you guys to join the live sessions with us. We think you can reap the full benefits from the sessions themselves by joining them live. So you get the opportunity to network in the chat, to talk with like-minded individuals. And if that is something that you are interested in or you want to know a little bit more about the podcast itself, please reach out to us either through our website or through the info@dataprotectionpeople.com email, and hopefully we can see you in the live session. But without further ado, we'll let you get right into it.
Well, thank you. I've been well. It's been a long week, and finally it's the weekend. How about you?
That's finally the weekend. Maybe that's a bit preemptive. but I'm great. Again, I've had a very busy weekend. For those that may or may not know, DPP has been on the road this week, or a couple of folks at DPP have, and we've been over at Risk Conference in London. I have had me and Katarina, the more regular hosts on the podcast, have had the opportunity to go down with the sales team and head over to Risk. That was great. It was a very busy week. It was really, really lovely and humbling to get to meet, hopefully, some of the people that are listening today. It's so amazing to see so many people come up to you and want to speak about the podcast or around the podcast. It's people noticing us from the podcast, even me. I mean, I appreciate that I've not been hosting this for a very long time, but anybody that has come over to speak about the podcast or ask about the podcast or anybody that's new from Risk today, hello and thank you very much. It's so nice, and I'm sure especially for Miles, who's been here since the podcast inception, it's so nice to see this community continue to grow and people continue to see value from it. So yeah, I just wanted to leave that little message there. But I digress. Let's get into the chunk of the session, which is in relation to having some of your guys' SAR questions answered. So what we've done off the back of the first podcast that me and Benga have done is we have jotted down a couple of questions that our very lovely business development manager, Jake, has managed to grab for us off the back of the first session. And we're just going to go through them and hopefully give you some decent answers. Well, we really do hope so. So we'll go through those from the start. If any of you guys have anything that you want to jump in with, maybe you want to unmute or you want to ask your own question, then absolutely feel free. So first question, Benga. I'm going to ask this one to you. In terms of SARS speaking in relation to social housing providers, people want to know where they draw the line on personal data. Where is it that you make that cut off? You know, can you take the stance, especially for social housing, the property level data will fall outside of scope, or do you tend would you tend to advise customers to provide this? You know, what is your view on that? On where do we draw the line on what identifies people and what doesn't?
Yeah, that's a very, very good question. So let me make it very easy with this kind of real life example. Let's think about it. Imagine you're a tenant named Sarah living in 42 DPP Street, and you make a SAR, right? The housing provider has records about Sarah, which is definitely personal data, and also has records about 42 DPP Street, which could be personal data or not. And I think this is where people get confused. Example one, let's say there's a leaky roof, property inspection report dated so date, 42 DPP Street, roof showing signs of water damage, requires urgent repair, tenant has complained about it multiple times. Is this about Sarah or about the property? Now, the answer to me is both. This is Sarah's personal data because one, it relates to our tenancy. Secondly, it mentions a specific complaint, and third, it affects our, living conditions. You cannot really separate the property issue from Sarah's experience. They're both. Then let me give an example. If the SAR comes again, structural survey of DPP block, all properties built in the 1980s, brick constructions, no major structural things, blah blah blah. Is this supposed to be considered as Sarah's personal data? The answer for me is no.
Okay.
You
How
know,
do you
that
feel about property information that predates or maybe discusses previous or close to discusses previous tenants of a property? Would you consider that in the scope still, or are we looking in the
no.
realms only of their tenancy?
Yes, because no, because this is about the building generally and not about Sarah's data specifically. She's not mentioned whatsoever. It doesn't relate to our tenancy. So I think the question you should be asking yourself is, one, does this tell you something about the person's relationship with us? If it is yes, it's personal data. Sarah's flat at 42 DPP Street has damp issues is about Sarah. Rent arrears 42 DPP Street is about Sarah. The repair request lodged by the tenant at 42 DPP Street is about Sarah. And when you mention all properties on that same street built in the 1970s, that is a general building information, not about Sarah itself. When you talk about standard maintenance, schedule for our estate, it's not about Sarah specifically, it's about the building itself. When you talk about the fire safety assessment for the block, these are general building safety. So the role for
I think it's how closely it links. I think
very
that's the key for me is there's it's really important with SARS to not get bogged down in the specificities of what is and isn't in scope when we're looking too broad. And I think property information is very, very key for this, and it links very closely into disrepair claims. Obviously, a lot of information read the disrepair claims are all about the property, and the actual heart and scope of the request is about the property itself. Which disrepair claims is something that we spoke obviously a lot about in the podcast. I feel very certain kind of ways about disclosing property information, especially in light of disrepair claims. You know, from the in-person session that we've had, I know a lot of people take the stance purely just to push back on these SARs altogether. You know, first and foremost, the property data isn't your personal data. There's a lot of stance that people takes. A lot of people like to provide it to be helpful. Sure, I appreciate that. And the matter of the fact is, they're going to get a lot of this information in the sort of pre-action protocol elements that occur in any sort of proceedings. I don't think exclusively the house information will always be in relation to the data subject themselves. I think it is all very context heavy. If we understand from the scope and nature of what they're asking for, the information relation to their tenancy and their living conditions could be important or could be prudent, then sure, I think it could be relevant to put it into scope. It's not always going to be 100% necessary, I think. You know what Amy is saying probably might resonate with a lot of people in the chat, actually. I from speaking to my customers know that a large chunk of the SARs that they get are all in relation to dish repair claims. I know there's been a lot of pushback on that recently. And, you know, as I said from the in-person event, a lot of people now are taking the stance of refusing them. I know that there was a solicitor going around recently, or probably quite a while ago now, to be fair, but saying that he can help people basically refuse all of the dish repair claims and has an argument that these are considered manifestly excessive. I don't hear as much about them anymore, interestingly enough. I don't know if that's because people are taking this sort of unified front with dish repair claims, but I do know in the main, a lot of people are refusing them. I don't know if there's anybody in the chat that is taking that kind of approach to dish repair claims at the moment, or whether it's just something that, you know, you're kind of used to the, okay, here's another one, we'll run through the same sort of process. Just because I feel like I don't hear about them very much anymore, or as much as we used to, for sure, because it used to be an everyday kind of thing for me.
Yeah, I would like to end with this. Given, like what I said earlier on the example, if the tenants moved out tomorrow, would the record still be about her? If yes, then it's personal data to me. You know, as long as the record is about her. And to end it again, if property data for me is personal data when it relates to the tenant's lived experience. Otherwise, it's not personal data. So whenever you are probably faced with something like this, do not overthink it. If it's about their home, it's about their tenancy, their complaints and repairs, it is definitely about them. And of course, it is personal data. Otherwise, no.
Okay. I mean, Charlotte's kind of covered up my point. I think that's what a lot of people are doing in relation to the dish repair claim stuff. So, yeah, that's some interesting insight. I've noticed that once you do pry further and they know that they're going to get, a lot of people do tend to bow out, don't they? And that seems to be really successful. I don't know if that's valuable to anybody else in the chat who may not be taking that approach. But from what I've seen in housing at the moment, that seems to be the stance. I don't know if that's something that was sort of like collectively seen or just something that's been followed as we've gone. So one of the other questions that we've had a lot recently, and something that I've seen throughout my course at Data Protection People, is where do we draw the line with the reasonable expectation of an individual's privacy? So I think the big thing that this probably relates to the most is in relation to staff, so your members of staff. So if an employee makes a SAR, how far do we go in redacting the names of staff or an email contents that mention staff or staff that are probably well known? If we look at education, things like a head teacher or a student, we'll probably know who their history teacher is, you know, stuff like that.
What is the expectation that we need to take to reasonably either choose to disclose their name or not to choose to disclose those names? And I think it's a balancing act, as is with everything in data protection. And it's not as clear cut as, you know, we do redact it or we don't. It's super context heavy. I think if we're looking at it from the realms of employee SARs,
we've got to look at what is the detriment to the other individual. It's not always about the right of the data subject. It's about respecting the right of all the other third parties involved. If we were to disclose that, you know, a staff had concerns about another member of staff, or maybe even that staff member was dropping emails to HR about stuff that they were doing, is there a risk for their privacy being breached? I mean, yeah, I think so. There's definitely risk of adverse things occurring to them, even just a lack of confidentiality. We see it very often in witness statements, in grievances and stuff like that, where we find that people are making the stance to not disclose that data. Of course, there is an exemption within the Data Protection Act to exempt that data. So it's when do we think it is necessary, or should it ever be necessary, to disclose any third-party data within that SAR?
Well, for me, when it comes to stuff about professional capacity, you know, very senior roles, routine businesses, I would advise don't redact. You shouldn't redact such, but then you can definitely redact stuff or information about personal opinion, you know, safety concerns. You know, that is very, very right. Everything else, don't redact. Use your judgment and always document why. Give reasons why you're doing this. Should any issues, you know, rise and lead you to the ICO. I feel you should disclose without redaction if the information, you know, you're acting in an official capacity, like making business decisions, providing official responses, stuff like that. You can do that without redacting. But anything otherwise, I don't think you should redact.
Yeah, I mean, Lucy makes a good point. You know, the staff are representing the business. We don't redact those unless there's a risk or if there's an exemption. Yeah, of course, I completely get that. Which I think it becomes difficult when you look at it from the internal perspective when we're looking at employees. But when a customer makes a SAR, if they're dealing with something or someone, and one, I think if they're dealing with someone, they're already going to reasonably understand who it was that they were talking to when this information is disclosed. So again, what's the likelihood of harm? If it's remote, if it's low, then we're probably in a position to disclose. It's always so context heavy. Who are we dealing with? What is this person like as an individual? Is this data subject contentious? Are they potentially known for harassing individuals? Do they have obviously any prior convictions that we're aware of? Is there any reason that them understanding this to a further level is going to be concerning and could not only put their data at harm, but potentially them at harm as well? And it definitely is one of the bigger questions that we get.
Yeah.
Hold on a minute. Can you just give me 5 minutes? Sorry.
I can't tell if you were talking to us there or not. I'm gonna assume or not. But if you did have something that you wanted to mention, then absolutely go ahead.
Yeah. So, Kane. So what, in your opinion, what counts as excessive reduction?
Gosh, that is a question, isn't it?
You know,
excessive reduction.
Because for me, reducting every staff name, regardless of the context, could be excessive.
Yeah. No. Well,
if you're reducing everybody's name, regardless of context, I think that could be excessive.
I think it links into what we're talking about right now with the staff names. You know, yeah. I think I've seen it with like phone calls, transcripts, emails between staff, where we understand where they're already talking about a third party. You know, if I'm corresponding with you, Benger, and you're my consultant. And I'm your customer, and I put in a SAR, you know, what is the need in redacting your email, your name? It's only all it leads to is the eventual complaint from the data subject that redactions are just too extensive. They don't understand it. If you are redacting something where possibly there is no actual context, where all you're receiving is nothing, a big fat nothing, really, and it's just all just big lines of redactions all over and over. It is, first and foremost, why are we even disclosing that if that is the case? You know, if that's all you're comfortable with in disclosing, it feels like it's not an attempt to fan the flames, but it will fan the flames. Because if you're looking at something and it's like, oh, we can only really redact like two words, we can only really disclose like two words here, then why are we doing it? Is there any benefit in even giving that to the data subject at this point? But is that because of concerns or maybe an over, I'm trying to think of the word, trying to be as secure as we can lead to overdoing it sometimes. And I think that's a real delicate game that DPOs have to play in understanding the whole context of things and not thinking too broadly about it. You know, I think people really get in their head about what they are disclosing. And I think it's the confidence in understanding what will be in scope, which is definitely difficult. David, I see that you've got your hand up. Do you wanna jump in?
Yeah, I will do, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think in my experience, and predominantly for me, I'm not dealing in some of the areas you're talking. Predominantly, it's employment, and the scope of employees, and in those areas, they're never satisfied. We could provide everything. And they wouldn't be so satisfied. We could redact heavily and you get Absolutely. That same level of dissatisfaction.
100%.
We take a position of we never disclose employees' names. We redact quite heavily. If it's not their personal data and the it doesn't give context, we don't provide it. We quite frequently don't provide it as a huge list of documents with three words in. We take it out as per guidance and put it into a separate document and provide a set of their personal data that was processed. So, you know, I think I'd be concerned if I was getting your guidance, I must admit, at the moment. And
in which regard, David?
With ICO, I think at least the way I'm taking out what you're suggesting, you wouldn't redact. I mean, we do this a lot and we clearly probably more heavily redact than you're suggesting. And, you know, we would provide a limited amount of context, you know, in lines with the guidance. But other than that, it's business information or it's other people's personal information. You're not getting it. Okay. We don't, you know, you've also got the thought that even if they know who it is, they're going to share it widely. Other people may not. And you're still releasing your employees' personal information. We don't do it.
Yeah, I think we redact away
from those situations in the most case. I absolutely get office of the business is entirely different, but that's office of the business and that's a different position entirely. You know, our offices of the business are a very senior group of individuals, not in the UK really. But so I was also going to mention, I don't know if you'd seen the piece coming out of IAP this week looking at the EU's proposals around simplification of its digital legislation. And it's a leaked, well, it's not a leak as in it's a pre-release, so it's not the final text that they're going to release, but there is talk about taking the sting out of DISA. And this is quoting IAP, so this is their take on reviewing it. I haven't seen the document, but it's taking the sting out of DISA as used as ammunition in employment trials. And what they're talking about is essentially putting in a purpose limitation. So when data subjects use data subject access requests for the purposes other than protecting their data, the controller will be either able to reject the DSAR or charge an appropriate fee for handling it. So we see a lot that are clearly for employment purposes, nothing to do with processing information. We tell them what information we're processing and they challenge. That's clearly not what they're after. For me, this would be moving towards a position where you could reject based on that or challenge. I realise this is Europe, not UK, but it's an interesting position because Europe is far less enforced. You know, ICO is probably the biggest proponent of DSARs at the level that you're talking. You see a little bit in Ireland. You see very rare cases in Spain and Germany and things we've had. You know, whereas we get a volume each year in UK and Ireland. Outside of that, we see very few, even in, you know, places as data privacy sensitive as Germany. We don't see this kind of request because in the main, most of the authorities don't support looking at email unless there are very serious circumstances. But still, going in that direction, it'd be interesting. And then if, yeah, hopefully ICO would follow suit, I'll post the article.
Yeah, I mean, that seems likely, doesn't it? That seems the way that they tend to go with these things is following that. I've not actually seen the article from IAP. I don't know if maybe what we've said is, I'm not sure if it's been misinterpreted. I don't know if I'm speaking too broadly, I suppose, but we're definitely not advocating for the disclosure of third party data where there is no benefit. I think it's only really in the context where they already understand what the information was. You know, if we were to discuss one to one, if the emails are going forward from people that I know, do you still take the stance always that is the data that's redacted? Obviously, I appreciate when correspondence is further than that. There's no need to disclose the third party in any sense, especially where they wouldn't.
In my experience in employment, virtually nobody is asking for just one person. They throw a blanket barrier. So we will advise the areas we will search and we won't search. So normally they don't have a huge piece on understanding exactly where the data's come from, because that would also give different exposure. So we just don't provide it. You know, we tend not to get, please just search David. It'll be, please search David, all his line managers, everybody may have ever spoken to, that kind of thing. So it's quite wide at that stage anyway.
Okay, sweet. Well, I absolutely appreciate the insight, David, and I definitely resonate with what you're saying. I'm not sure if, I don't know if maybe it's the way that we've communicated it that's been concerning, but it's definitely good to get your line of thinking. It's always it's always very helpful when you're on mute. We've got a few other people with their hands up as well, so I'm mindful that we'll get to them before the end of the session. Lucy, do you wanna share some of your thoughts with us?
Yeah, I mean, I was just going to say, I think it's really important to note that every organisation will carry out redactions differently. If you give one document to me to redact, I'll probably redact it completely different to how you might redact it. And on sort of like the opposite end of what David was saying, we probably over-provide. So I work for a housing association. So with our customers, I'm aware that a lot of housing associations don't provide like repair history for the property, for example. But And although it's not disclosable under SAR because it's not personal data, it's property data around repairs, we do still provide that to our customers. And the reason for that is because a lot of our SARs do come in around complaints and repairs not being done. So by us not providing that, it's not helpful to the customer. So we're always sort of thinking there's a customer at the end of it. No, it's not personal data, but actually there's no harm in us giving that to the customer, if that makes sense. And similarly with employee SARs, if there's sort of like an internal thread, if somebody's going through a grievance, for example, and there's an internal thread with HR and the person's line manager, and they're sort of just discussing the process, we're probably, although it's about the process and not about that specific employee situation, we're probably more inclined to leave that in because it does give that employee who's going through that process, it gives them that insight. And I know a lot of people won't agree with some of the things I've said about leaving in, but as I say, I think every organisation is going to do things differently. And we sort of just think back to, yes, we do think, is it their personal data? No, don't provide. Is it their personal data? Yes, do provide. But we also think, actually, is there any harm in providing that, and is it going to provide a better service for them by providing it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I it's great to get the sort of a very different opinion as opposed to what David shared as well. I think that is the key, and I think that's what we're coming to, is there's very obviously no clear way or defined way where people are going about this. And I think it ties down to many a thing, what the approach of data protection is in the organization, factors in terms of contents, the approach we take as a whole. You know, do we look at it from the perspective of trying to appease the customer as best as we can? Are we trying as best as we can to respect and refrain the rights of all the third parties involved? And that's what we see with SARs, and that's why it's so clearly such a interesting topic in data protection law. Is I don't think there's anybody who thinks the same. Well, there'll be people who think the same way, but I think collectively not everybody is thinking the same way, and that leads to loads of very interesting discourse as much as we're having today. Tina, I know that you've also got your hand up as well, so it'd be great to get your insights as well.
Yeah, I agree with somewhat what David was saying. Like, it'd be good to have a discussion with, you know, the employer who has put the SAR in, and just explain to them what they will not be getting. So a lot of SARs that we get are asking for, obviously going through a lot of grievances, ones that we get, the one witness statements or things that they've specifically put that in their scope, and obviously they're not allowed that, we've not got third party consent for one, and if the other people are involved in the grievance against that person, that puts them in a very difficult position. It's not allowed, it's exempt from disclosure. So
yeah, no, absolutely,
they do think that they're going to get things that what people have said about them, or you know, any complaints that people have made against that person. So it's good to let
them. Is that a lack of individuals on understanding what their own rights are, or maybe them just pushing their luck, I suppose? But yeah, I completely agree with you.
There is a lot, like most of the grievance ones, they're asking for that information. They ask for you know, any witness statements that anybody's put in, or any complaints that anyone's putting against them, any meeting notes that were taken behind, you know, where they weren't involved. So with the people that have made any witness statements, or so we do get a lot of that. So that's interesting. It's just interesting because I don't even know why they would think that they could have that information.
Yeah, but, well, I think it's an attempt to push their luck, isn't it, Tina?
A lot of digging's involved with employees as they're wanting to find out what's going on behind the scenes.
Well,
and a lot of the time, there's not a lot going on behind the scenes.
No, of course. It's a lot of it's just that Amy's right, looking for the smoking gun. And I think an important point, and one that Lawrence has raised, and one that we haven't really touched in relation to of this, which is interesting given the context, is the third-party exemption obviously exists for a reason, to protect those third parties. And I think the context of, do we disclose third party data, is so broad. Of course, people will agree and disagree, and it will always depend on the context. That exemption exists to protect the rights of those third parties, which means where that is the case and where we're concerned, we can always apply on that exemption where it is applicable. And I think it comes down to what people's approaches are. You know, Lucy will do on her end what she thinks is the safest to satisfy the customer and give them whatever they can, even if it's not necessarily the scope of personal data. Whereas some people want to take the approach of doing whatever they can to protect that third party right, which is what they absolutely should do. And that is the key and the paramount of what we do in data protection law. So I don't think it's the case where, okay, blanket, we keep it in scope or we don't keep it in scope. These will always flow and change, and people may have the same approach across the board. And if that works, then absolutely it works. I think maybe the distinction is that maybe the issue is that everybody treats it so differently, but there's no way to have a unified approach when everything, I suppose, is already as vague as it is, and requests become more varied and more complex with things like the use of AI to sort of spam out these requests, make them sound very significant and complex and a little bit confusing and throw you through a loop. So, you know, it's very, very valuable to get the insights of some of the individuals in the community. So I thank you all very much for getting involved, and Tina as well, of course.
Yes, amazing too. My final words on this is, whenever you're in doubt, ask yourself, if the staff member saw this email disclosed with their name visible, would they reasonably expect you to have been redacted? If the answer is no, I was just doing my job, then you are within your right to disclose. But if the answer is yes, that was my personal opinion and concern, then you should redact.
Well, I think the key is, I think the key is that is no hard and fast. I think people could choose whatever
works
decision they want in relation to them. Again, the key is, are you, one, is there an exemption that is able to be provided? Can we, if we don't want to disclose it, is there an exemption? I mean, usually if you don't want to disclose something,
yeah,
there's a fairly good reason for doing so, especially in relation to third party. If you're ever unsure, then you should always take the decision of protecting the right of the third parties. If that's the decision you take, then that is absolutely not a wrong one. But if you believe that on the adverse, there is ways that you could provide third party data that is still protecting the rights of those third parties, then again, it's a route that works. You know, we are not here to tell you what shouldn't work for your organization. So yeah. I think that the key is in understanding that is what works for the business, what works for you guys, and how you can uphold those third party rights, because that will always be the key. How do we uphold the rights of everybody involved?
Yeah, and I would say always document your decisions. You know, so if challenged ever, you can show that you've applied a consistent and reasoned approach to it.
Yeah, links to what Tina says, doesn't it? We need to communicate with the data subject. Transparency and communication will always be key. If someone asks for something and we know and understand that they're probably not going to get it, then communicate with them with the offset. You know, it's best to start on the best foot that they can. Let them know what we're searching for, what's in scope. That's why clear response letters, clear correspondence, even when we're looking at sending off the SAR, they know exactly what the case is in relation to the SARs. So there is no doubt that we've done everything we can to communicate transparently.
Yeah. And I also think, closing words, while the DORA Act does not specifically change the reduction rules, the reasonable and proportionate search principle means you can now focus on your reduction efforts. So if the site's about housing repairs, for example, you don't need to spend so much hours redacting names from HR emails and staff trainings and blah, 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 that does not mention anything about the tenant in practice. So reasonable and proportionate just means focus reduction where it matters.
Sweet. Well, on that note, we will wrap bits off for today. I think next week is a GDPR radio session as normal. So that should be a nice first hand one invite going out next week. So thank you very much all for joining, and hopefully we shall see you in the next one.
Thank you
guys.